Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show on this Tuesday. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West is with us at the bottom of the hour. And Dave Ignatius, columnist for The Washington Post. He's going to be here in a matter of moments. And, of course, we'll be taking your calls. And you can write me to BrianKilmeade.com. And let me remind you, really excited about our YouTube page. So YouTube.com/@TheBrianKilmeade Show. We have all new material, great content. Hopefully the gods above will put us in your algorithm. So before we get to Dave, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I think the Virginia case was particularly powerful. He took this map, would have been 6-5 Democrats over Republicans, and turned it into one that looks like it could be as much as 10-1. The Supreme Court may yet have a say on that, but this is another place it would be a good idea to turn the temperature down and get back to the old customs.
Gerrymandering on trial as Florida is now front and center as Virginia's massive left flip under the legal microscope. Where do you stand on all this?
Number two.
At the moment, I cannot see what strategic exit the Americans are now opting for, especially as the Iranians are very skillfully not negotiating and letting the Americans travel to Islamabad. This entire nation is being humiliated by the Iranian state leadership.
Screw you. That is the Chancellor of Germany. Iran's new peace proposal falls far short, but would open up the strait, but nothing about nukes or about their uranium or about the funding of Hezbollah and Hamas. But it's a little different for them to offer that. Oh, meanwhile, Iran's oil is unable to be sold. It's overflowing right now. Wells could be capped.
Number one. Let this be a message to anyone who thinks that Washington, D.C. is the place to act out political violence. We will find you. We will track your steps from the inception of your plan, and we will prosecute you.
Yep, that is Jeanine Pirro. You recognize the voice and the stance. More on the investigation into the Correspondents' Dinner shooting, Secret Service under scrutiny, and Trump has to demand changes as we learn about the shooter. We have another guy who feels as though it's his duty to kill a politician, to kill someone of prominence like Charlie Kirk. Just some of the screed that I read, it just reminds me of some of the last shooters. They are mobilized and radicalized, and they sometimes are killing for the first time. You know, you're not saying with someone, well, they've been arrested 35 times. This is just their latest crime, and it's a big one. A lot of these guys are first-time offenders, which to me can be even more intimidating. Dave Ignatius joins us now, columnist for The Washington Post, to the latest on the conflict with Iran, but as well as Ukraine. Dave, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Brian.
First off, I read your column, excited about it. I want to get to it. But first, the latest proposal, just for our audience to understand, roughly the Iranians said, if you stop the blockade, we'll open up the strait and then begin talks about their nuclear program. Trump is not excited about it. But what's different about this proposal?
Well, the difference is to propose to do it in phases, with an initial phase focused on reopening the strait, which is obviously a priority. I don't like the proposal because I don't think Iran really gives up enough, either on the Strait. It proposes to maintain control and the ability to charge tolls on the Strait.
Oh, ridiculous. I didn't know that. Sorry about that.
Yeah, so that's the first part. And the second part, the concessions they're willing to offer on the nuclear program still would leave many aspects of it intact, or at least easily rebuilt. And I think if there's a consensus about anything, it is that Iran really can't have a nuclear weapon. They simply haven't behaved responsibly enough to be allowed to do that. I think President Trump has a real problem, Brian, in that he's gone far down this road. He'd like to end the war, it's obvious, but he wants to end it on terms that are good for the United States, and it's just not an easy path yet to do that.
Do you think that this is likely heading to a reignition of the conflict in full-blown war again?
I had a long conversation yesterday with someone very close to President Trump who said, basically, it's time to go back to war. They're not listening to us. I think that would be a tough decision for the president. I think, Brian, he wants out. But the Iranians are playing tough. They think they've got the strategic advantage here. And it's one of those situations, to be honest, I think President Trump faces only bad choices or no good choices here.
So, you know, what's interesting. I mean, to finish up, they think they have 10 more days of targets. And number two, by shutting off with the blockade, they're not allowing Iran to get their oil out, even to their GO ships. So the front page of The Wall Street Journal today and other sources, Arab News, they're saying that they're coming up with defective tankers, condemned tankers, yeah, in order to store their oil. If they have to cap those wells, that's what they're probably extremely concerned about.
So the best proposal I've heard from the Trump team, think of a USC fighting match where one guy's got the other in a submission hold, a chokehold, until he taps out. So he says, I just can't continue. That's what the administration thinks they may have with this blockade, a chokehold where Iran simply won't be able to get revenue. If the U.S. can sustain it for months, Iran will tap out. It will have no alternative. But it'll take a lot of discipline. We've got an election coming up. It's hard to know. But I think that's the closest they have to a strategy right now that wouldn't involve sending troops into Iran, which nobody wants to do.
Here is number 30.
If there is no deal, what comes next?
Well, again, that's the president's decision to make. I would start out by reminding everybody that the level of sanctions on Iran are extraordinary. The pressure on Iran is extraordinary. And I think more can be brought to bear. But I hope that in the aftermath of this conflict, the whole world's eyes have been opened to the threat Iran poses.
So, you know, he knows a war is an option, but he's not going to get ahead of the president. Is this really a president that makes his own decisions, right?
Sure seems to be.
Yeah. I want you to hear what Friedrich Merz said. I was stunned by the German chancellor through a translator, obviously. Cut 33.
At the moment, I cannot see what strategic exit the Americans are now opting for, especially as the Iranians are obviously negotiating very skillfully, or rather very skillfully not negotiating and letting the Americans travel to Islamabad, only to leave again without any results. This entire nation is being humiliated by the Iranian state leadership, especially by these so-called Revolutionary Guards.
Number one, they had one meeting, 121 hours. They couldn't even, the Iranians couldn't agree, and I never thought they were going to work out one day. So what do you think was the method to that statement? Because that is, those are words to lead to a response if you've met the president before.
So why Merz use language like that, humiliated? I mean, things that are certain to upset Trump or any president, I don't know. My feeling, Brian, in general, is that the Europeans have to understand that they have as big a stake as anybody in reopening the Strait and having a successful outcome here, and they need to help more. I think on some issues like Greenland, they have legitimate concerns, but on this, there ought to be more unity than there has been, and I hope Chancellor Merz gets with it.
But were you surprised, knowing that, you know, they had that pretty good meeting in, prior to the war in the Oval Office, that he was here being humiliated? It's obviously not accurate unless you're, you know, dealing from the Iranians' communications division.
So the problem is and you see this across Europe, Brian, it's becoming politically popular at home to take shots at President Trump. People are pretty angry. So I think that's part of what you're seeing in Merz's comments. He's playing to his domestic audience. And, you know, somehow this alliance, what's left of it, is going to have to pull together to get a good outcome in Iran and just generally in the world. The world's, it's a tough time now, and people need to pull together.
So just looking at the Iran thing, if we go back to the campaign, we're putting more and more assets in the region. I mean, there's no sense. If they were pulling out, I would say, listen, the president's like losing his leverage here. But they're actually bulking up in the area, and they're bringing in more defense. And we see Ukraine is now helping out. Excuse me, Israel is helping out the UAE with their version of the Iron Dome. So I get the sense the region's bracing for another round. And we're going to find out really how much damage is done. Do you get a sense of how much damage was done and not done to the Iranians?
So my sense is that the damage to the major nuclear facilities was significant. I mean, they're buried. It'll be years before they can be put back together. The damage to the Navy, as President Trump has often said, was overwhelming. Damage to the missile launchers, substantial. There are a lot of missiles that they still have secreted away that they can fire. I think the big issue for me, Brian, is how damaged is the structure that makes Iran such a dangerous and repressive government? How damaged really is the Revolutionary Guard, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps? And they still seem to be pretty strong, and they still seem to be calling the shots. There are a lot of people in Iran who'd like to make a deal. The IRGC is just, you know, basically shouting down. So that's what worries me. And so that, because how do you break their power without invading the country, without doing things we really wouldn't want to do? We wouldn't want another Iraq, for goodness sake. So how do you break that power? And I'll be honest, I find myself trying to think about it. I don't think there are any easy. Anybody who says there are easy answers to this, no, I don't think is paying attention.
Well, I do think that the intelligence that the Israelis have and the assassination elimination squads might be very effective. We got to get that internet back on to let the people take back their country, if it's indeed possible. And I would hope there's a program to arm the people. I don't. Yeah. They don't need howitzers, but they need some way to fight back. Because maybe 1,500,000, let's say at the most, 500,000 people like the regime. That leaves 90 million who don't. So if we could find some way to empower the people, we have no interest in any of their assets. We just don't want an enemy in the region. I want to talk about Ukraine. Ukraine, the headline is Ukraine took Russia's best punch. It wants to teach Europe what it learned. And you found out when you went there, you were inspired, and they are no longer losing.
So, Brian, I was there last week, and I came away. It's funny. I came away feeling uplifted that you know, the Ukrainians have just fought so bravely against this, to me, unprovoked Russian invasion.
Of course.
And they're holding their own. They have found ways to fight the most modern war ever. They've been incredibly inventive using drones. I talked to a lot of people who make drones, and, you know, just back from the front, and they go to their factories and they redesign the drones, they redesign the electronics to, you know, outpace the Russians. I found a country that had really kind of gotten itself together. It feels, you know, let's be honest, it feels abandoned by President Trump in the United States, but they've decided we're going to, you know, go it on our own. The Europeans are stepping up and helping them. So I'd like to see the Iranians be successful in this war. And I came away with a feeling that there's a better chance of that than I would have thought. The last time I was there was in January. Certainly in the last few months, they seem to have steadied their nerve.
I mean, they're really losing 1,000 a week?
They're losing that. I mean, the Russians.
That's what I mean.
Your listeners, Russians in March had 35,000 dead and seriously wounded, I'm told by
intelligence. That's astounding.
35,000 in a month. It's the level of violence in this war, people just can't imagine. And Ukrainians are just, they're way outmatched in terms of people, but not in terms of ingenuity and commitment. And I think the Russians at some point, and just the Russian people, have got to say, hey, boss, you know, this lasted longer than World War II, and what have we gotten out of it? We haven't even conquered Donetsk province. Does this make sense? I mean, at some point, that's going to happen in Russia.
Ukraine neutralizes, you say, 70% of Russian drone attacks to boost the kill rate to more than 90% by the end of the year. They're out innovating, the Russians, who have mass producing weapons, but they're not out innovating and they don't seem motivated. So this is pretty astounding. I was with General Petraeus last week, and he said, if you want to find out the future of warfare, he goes, don't look at Iran, look at Ukraine. He said it's amazing what he's taking place.
He's absolutely right, Brian. And he's followed this carefully. He goes out to the front every time he goes there. I mean, General Petraeus really kept a good eye on this.
So the United Arab Emirates has left OPEC effective May 1st. What's the impact of that?
Oh, boy. I think the UAE is moving away from so many of its traditional commitments. They feel isolated from the Saudis, angry still. I don't know enough about oil markets to give you a good account about what that would actually mean in terms of prices. But you're going to have more independence. More, you know, they'll move closer to the U.S. Maybe. Well, it's just hard to say.
You know, it's interesting. Same with me. I mean, they were just asking me before OPEC just left. I was on Fox and Friends, and I go, I never saw that. And they left OPEC. I go, I never saw this coming. Let me find out about it. What does this actually mean? But I'll tell you what. Listen to them talk at the, you know, diplomatic level. They sound like a Western country. I haven't been there. I'm sure you have.
I've been there a ton of times. I mean, they're UAE is a miracle, and they have made a break. They're more like Singapore than they are another Arab state. There's something so modern. Brilliant people running the country. They really feel on the other end of the Iranian, war machine. That they feel very vulnerable, and.
Got to get them interceptors, got to get them more anti-drone technology, and they brought in the Ukrainians to help out.
Yep, they're gonna. If I was in the weapons business, I'd be on a plane to the UAE trying to sell them stuff, I'll tell you that.
Hey, Dave Ignatius, always great to have you on. Thanks for doing the hard work, and I love that you're telling a good story. Different from last year, there's a good story to be told with Ukraine. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, Brian.
You got it. We're going to take a short time out and come back. We know also the king and queen are in town, and normally I'd say, okay, nice ceremony, big deal. They'll have a nice dinner tonight, but I think it's much more than that, and I'll tell you why. Don't move.
Real talk, real guests, real insight. Where curiosity meets conversation. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It was a very light roast joke about the fact that he's almost 80 and she's younger than I am. It was not, by any stretch of the definition, a call to assassination. And they know that. I've been very vocal for many years speaking out against gun violence in particular. I am sorry that you and the president and everyone in that room on Saturday went through that. I really am. Just because no one got killed doesn't mean it wasn't traumatic and scary. And we should come together and be best. We really should.
So that is... not an apology. That is Jimmy Kimmel doubling down, in my view, of comments he made. And the joke was simple. It was not funny, but he said, he stood there, just picture this. There's video of Melania sitting in a crowd, and he goes, she looks so beautiful. He goes, that's the glow. She's wearing the glow of an assassination. Okay? Of a widow. You're wearing the glow of a widow. Really? Okay. Besides his audience, which will laugh at anything, because they wouldn't have been lining up for days and running away for tickets. You think to yourself, I mean, how crass is that? No one who's already been shot at twice. And who knows another? Well, it happened that weekend. And for people to say he had no problem with it when it aired, of course, because no one watches. You think Melania's watching and was shocked? She would have said something, more than likely. But there's not a Trump person that would ever put on your show.
Show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
You have to be able to sweep it. Now, I will tell you, when you don't own the building, when you only own a portion of that building, it makes it very difficult. Now, you have to realize that if you go up and sweep all 10 floors, 1,100 rooms, after you sweep it, you have to post it. Because if you walk away, you got to sweep it again. You have to maintain the integrity of the sweep. So that would have been one heck of a challenge to do that. And I don't think it could have been done. So in other words, that venue was not appropriate for this event.
Frank Loveridge, Fox News at night, he's a retired Secret Service agent, looking over the security plan, not the actions after the shooting, but the plan that allowed the shooting to be pulled off. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West joins us now. Colonel, what are your thoughts about Saturday? Does it seem preventable to you?
It's very hard, once again, because as he just alluded to, when you have a venue such as the Washington Hilton, I've been there several times, and it is a place where people are staying. It's a hotel. You would indeed have to go up there and clear all of those rooms, and then you would have to post people pretty much so at every floor or every other floor along the stairwells and what have you. You probably have to shut down the elevators. So you put an inconvenience on the people that are staying there, unless you completely shut down the whole hotel and say that in this block of time, no one can be occupying their rooms. So I think that's one of the things you have to look at is you can have the outer cordon, as we call it, a security cordon, but you also have to have an inner cordon. And when you look at a facility like the Washington Hilton, there's so many different avenues, there's so many different exits, there's so many different corridors, there's so many different ways, as what Cole Allen showed us, for you to be able to penetrate the internal of the inner cordon and be able to come close. I don't think he would have succeeded, but he came darn close.
And we don't even know who shot the officer because it's not in the affidavit.
Yeah.
And we don't know. I mean, I read an eyewitness say that she saw him shoot at least 10 times, 10 bullets. Okay.
Yeah.
But I don't have any confirmation on that. I just saw a couple eyewitnesses. And when, if he did shoot 10 times, man, are we lucky that he didn't hit anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure the ballistics will let us know. He did have a pistol. He did have a shotgun. I was looking at the DOJ press conference. They said that there was at least one shotgun shell that was fired from that 12 gauge. But I don't know if he discharged his handgun, the semi-automatic at all. But the ballistics will give us that. But yeah, I mean, if he did fire 10 times and not hit anyone, and there's some, you know, issues about whether the Secret Service agent that was friendly fire, again, very fortunate, very lucky that he was not a good marksman.
So, well, we'll see what happens. Would you do it again in 30 days? President says, let's do this. Let's do it again.
Well, I think one of the things you want to look at is that you don't want anyone to believe that that side wins, the side of violence, the side of people that wants to, you know, shut you down, intimidate you, coerce you. So, yes, I think it would be important to do that. I don't know if I'd go back to that venue, though.
Yeah, that's interesting, too. And we won't have a ballroom yet. So we'll see where this goes. Here's Todd Blanche yesterday. Cut one.
Violence has no place in civic life. It cannot and will not be used to disrupt democratic institutions or intimidate those who serve them, and it certainly cannot continue to be used against the President of the United States. We are investigating this matter fully. We will apply the law fairly, and we will ensure that accountability is swift and certain. But we also should recognize what did not happen. Law enforcement did not fail. They did exactly what they are trained to do.
So when the shooting happened, from what you saw, were you pleased with the actions?
Yes. What you saw was everyone knew exactly their positions, their roles, their duties, responsibilities. You saw immediately people get in and secure that stage. They went in and all the protected assets, I think that's the right terminology, they got to them to immediately get them out. And one of the good things that I liked about this, as opposed to what we saw at Butler, they kept the President of the United States of America down. They kept him shielded as they extricated him from that stage. stage. And you even saw a Secret Service agent get up there on that stage and take a position right in front of where the president was standing. So I think that without a doubt, their immediate reaction drills were very good.
All right, so we'll talk about that. I just want to talk a little bit about the shooter in 2024. He seems to have gotten very much into politics, formed his own version of a woke out of the No Kings March. So somehow he gets radicalized. What role do you think the rhetoric has to radicalizing the Charlie Kirk killer, killers like this guy, would-be assassin, would-be assassin over in Butler? What role do you think social media has in this and some of the rhetoric coming out of Washington?
Well, it's huge, without a doubt. I mean, we can go all the way back to the Republican baseball team that was shot. And, of course, Steve Scalise, God bless him, did not lose his life, but he's still affected by that. So you hear the left always talking about tamping down the rhetoric. They don't mean it. They're not going to do it. They continue to go out and use, you know, authoritarians, dictators, Hitler, all of these different images, because what they really seek to do is dehumanize their political opposition so that you have people like this that think that they're going to be a hero. And when you allow someone like a Hassan Piker to go on with New York Times and talk about and praise political violence and assassinations, and praise a guy like Luigi Mangione, who shot the healthcare CEO, and talk about, you know, justifying burglary and theft and things of this nature. This has no place in the society of the United States of America. And without a doubt, we've got to shut this down.
Yeah. So I want you to, Akeem Jeffries was said, hey, guys, you got to cover that rhetoric and the way you talk about Trump and Hitler and authoritarian and, you know, democracy in the balance. And then Akeem Jeffries uses his term, is going to be maximum warfare on gerrymandering.
Yeah.
And then was asked to walk back this statement. Listen to what he says, cut 14.
The notion that any of us are concerned with so-called criticism from these phony Republicans as it relates to anything that has been said, certainly as it relates to the comment related to maximum warfare everywhere, all the time, in connection with the redistricting battle that Republicans launched. I stand by it. You can continue to criticize me for it. I don't give a damn about your criticism.
So does that sound like a guy that's going to watch his words?
No, it doesn't. And as a matter of fact, I mean, he is not double down, he's triple down, he's quadruple down. And that is the problem. When you have people on their side of the aisle that, you know, will not stand up and say, hey, look, we're getting this wrong, and we need to use different language. If he wants to talk about the redistricting, just say those words. We have to look at how we can redistrict to counter what the Republicans have done. But even when you listen to phony Republicans, I mean, always adding in these adjectives, these descriptions that are unnecessary, extremists and things of this nature. If you believe in the Constitution, all of a sudden you're extremist. So, no, I don't see anything changing. But thank God you had one Democrat member of Congress, I think she's from the state of Washington, who said, you know, please, let's stop trying to kill our president or the president.
It's like laughable. It's the most basic statement ever, but that's it. Except for Fetterman.
And so we have gotten to that point where a member of Congress from the Democrat Party has to say, stop trying to kill the president. But then you have Hakeem Jeffries, the minority leader, saying that I don't give a you know what. I'm going to continue to say what I want to say. You can criticize me all you want. So, no, there's no lessons learned from them.
So I want you to hear, as we talk about the war in Iran, the president's got an offer. We'll open up the strait. They're going to open up the strait, still charge tolls, and want us to release the blockade. It's a laughable offer. Meanwhile, Friedrich Merz, the German chancellor, said this through a translator. Cut 35.
At the moment, I cannot see what strategic exit the Americans are now opting for, especially as the Iranians are obviously negotiating very skillfully, or rather very skillfully not negotiating and letting the Americans travel to Islamabad, only to leave again without any results. This entire nation is being humiliated by the Iranian state leadership, especially by these so-called Revolutionary Guards.
Do you tell me if that assessment is the same as yours?
I will tell you that right now we're negotiating with ourselves. We're not negotiating with Iran. And first of all, we don't know who we're negotiating with in Iran. Look, the bottom line is we need to take control of the Strait of Hormuz. We have that capability and capacity to do so. That should not be under the control of Iran in any way, shape, form, or fashion. We need to go in and seize Karg Island to once again separate them from their oil and gas revenues. And we can be the ones that can control that flow of oil and gas through the straits. And we need to keep the blockade on Iran. So, again, I don't think sitting around and saying we're having talks, we're having negotiations and these things with Iran is going to go anywhere. They are just trying to run this clock out. They watch our news, and they see what is happening as far as the opposition. They see Americans complaining about gasoline prices. So let's just do what Americans can do and what our military is able to do. And going back to 1997, we did a battle simulation about this. Open up the Straits of Hormuz, let's control it, and just push Iran aside and let that regime topple from within.
Well, the oil is already overflowing. They're getting defective tankers and rolling them out to just be able to store the oil. Soon they're going to have to cap those wells. But I will say this, for an ally, to say we're being humiliated in the middle of conversations, I mean, I could see, well, you know, if the Russians said that and if the Chinese made a statement like that, it would jeopardize our visit there in a few weeks. To see the Germans with absolutely no defense for the last 70 years, 80 years, make that statement about an ally, I find that indefensible.
Well, I tell you, when I was in Afghanistan, the German military that was there, their number one health risk or casualty rate was about obesity. So I don't think that the chancellor there, German, should be saying anything about the United States of America, because once again, they come running to us all the time to help them, you know, be in it with Ukraine or what have you. And so, again, I would say that we just be focused on what we can do as a nation to open up the strait. We have that capability. We have that capacity. And once again, we can prevent China from having another free flow of underpriced oil. We've already done that with Venezuela. Let's do it again with Iran.
I know, but it does bother me that an ally would talk like that, says we're being humiliated. He's playing to his base because he's got a bunch of Muslims there that came over during Merkel's reign. So now it's cool. It's cool to be tough with Trump. We'll see. We'll see how that comes out.
Well, that's all across Europe. I mean, that's why you see Keir Starmer, France, now Germany, because they have lost control of their domestic situation, and they have an Islamic jihadist problem there, and they're kowtowing to it. They're being held hostage to it.
They better watch themselves. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, thanks so much.
Appreciate it, Brian. God bless.
I'm with you. Take Karg Island, and we're going to have to I think we're going to end up back there another 10 days going after them. I know the oil markets will go up, but in the end, they need to know they lost, and they don't seem to care because they don't care about their own people and the suffering that's taking place. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. You can write me, briankilmeade.com. I'm going to go through your emails or be on the lines, 1-866-408-7669.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Check this video out. The left side of your screen, this man, creative artist, agent, super agent, Michael Glantz, has gone viral for eating food casually as people are crouched down after this shooting at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Excuse me, waiter. When you're done incapacitating the assassin, I would love some more ranch dressing. It'd be a doll if you could, a refill. Some lady took my wine.
It's so funny, right? I mean, look, everyone's been through it. You know, you're not going to him for the breaking news. I thought it was funny. That was Michael Glantz.
No, it was great on the salad. If you want to hear another clip, it's very good. He, John Stewart, goes after RFK and Stephen Miller.
All right, let's hear this.
RFK Jr. being whisked away by a Secret Service hive who apparently couldn't spare one worker bee for, I don't know, his wife. There's a group of men carrying another man out of the room. And then there's a woman. A woman. who appears to be, desperately reaching out for someone to care, to help her. That's the woman reaching up in agony and fear. That's RFK Jr.'s wife. Bobby! By the way, if there's
what happened is she's from Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Cheryl Hines,
yeah. So he was sitting one table away from me. They grabbed him quickly. I thought his wife was ahead of him. I didn't know that was her behind until I watched that show.
Yeah, reaching out, help.
I know, just reach back for a second. But hey, things happen quick. Let's listen more.
In that entire room, who seems like they would be impervious to physical damage, f***ing RFK Jr. Look at this guy. He literally looks like a guy who is trapped between being Bruce Banner and the Hulk. I want to show you something. Pay attention to the foreground. Something's about to happen. I want to show it to you. Hold on. It's not there. They're whisking RFK out. His wife. Freeze. Okay. The guy right there, shielding the pregnant woman from danger, that's Stephen Miller and his wife. Stephen Miller carefully protecting his wife. See, RFK, turned out that's an option. You can protect your wife instead of, I don't know, beating her to the escape pod. And the guy who outshined you is Stephen f***ing Miller. That's who outshined you. That's who was more chivalrous. Stephen Miller, a guy who probably to the new Faces of Death movie. That's... And now for the rest of your life, your wife is going to ask you a question no one's ever asked before, ever. Why can't you be more like Stephen Miller? Why? Why can't you be more? But no, there goes RFK, just leaving it. Looks like we got a new addition to the Kennedy family abandoning women to their fate Wikipedia page. Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, that's pretty funny. Yeah.
Wasn't it fantastic? Yeah. I mean, so funny.
Right. So he did, and there was a lot of craziness. What about the woman stealing the wine?
Yeah. It started
there. Bottles.
But I mean, the agent eating the salad was all the much better. But I mean, this is how you do it. He made fun of everyone and what all happened.
Yeah. That's
versus
funny.
Kimmel, who's just angry.
Yeah. I mean, does he hate Trump? Yes. So what does that do with the show?
Right? You can still find something funny in almost every situation.
I just think Bill Maher showed you the combination if you're a comedian. He showed you the combination. Like, he has his open, half of it is anti the administration, the other half is the absurdity of some of the attacks on the administration. And I was hoping Jon Stewart started off a little bit more balanced, but it's just funny. All I can tell you, even the stuff, I mean, some of he portrays inaccurate, but it's comedy, it's exaggeration. So it reminds me that I still have my sense of humor when I watch somebody who I don't agree with politically, but I understand how funny he is.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Have one, Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much for listening. Our chance to talk about what's happening locally. We talk about happening locally, talk about what's happening nationally. Locally in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, give you an idea of what's happening there. Internationally, we'll bring you to the war zone over in Iran and give you an idea of what's happening because that's got occupying 50,000 of our troops and three aircraft carriers. Pierre DeBoss is coming on, the managing director of Romer DeBoss, and he is going to be talking about this whole tax the rich, wealth tax, and what it means for his businesses and what we're hearing now in California and New York and other places. They think taxing the rich, the wealth tax, is going to get them out of debt, and Chandler Painter is going to be with us too. So before we get to our first guest, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
I think the Virginia case was particularly powerful. He took this map, would have been 6-5 Democrats over Republicans, and turned it into one that looks like it could be as much as 10-1. The Supreme Court may yet have a say on that, but this is another place it would be a good idea to turn the temperature down and get back to the old customs.
Yep, here we go. Gerrymandering on trial as Florida is now front and center. They're going to do it. Virginia's massive left flip is now under a legal microscope. We'll see if the Supreme Court's going to let it stand. Where do you stand?
Number two.
At the moment, I cannot see what strategic exit the Americans are now opting for, especially as the Iranians are very skillfully not negotiating and letting the Americans travel to Islamabad. This entire nation is being humiliated by the Iranian state leadership.
That unbelievable. That's a translator talking about Frederick Merz. We're being humiliated. You know what? The EU and NATO, you guys are on death's door with us. Iran's new peace proposal falls far, far, far short, but would open up the strait. But they'll still charge tolls. Nothing about the uranium. Nothing about getting rid of your nuclear program. So nothing is going to go. And I'll tell you what, time is not on their side as oil is overflowing because they can't ship it.
Number one.
Let this be a message to anyone who thinks that Washington, D.C. is the place to act out political violence. We will find you, we will track your steps from the inception of your plan, and we will prosecute you.
Hopefully preemptively next time, more on the investigation into the correspondence dinner shooting, the Secret Service under scrutiny about their setup, but not how they acted under pressure, that's for sure. Here's Kash Patel, cut three.
This one hits a little differently. We were all there. Many of you were there. Many of you watching were there as well. The president was there. The vice president was there. The cabinet was there. And what you saw, described by the general and the U.S. attorney, is absolutely true. The president spoke on late Saturday evening with the message of unity and a backing of law enforcement, and we have followed through on that message of unity and the effectuation of law enforcement across this country.
So that is Kash Patel. He's got to get to the bottom of this. You got to see how this all works together. You know, I had Ro Khanna on Fox and Friends. He said, well, you shouldn't have the Secret Service in Homeland Security anyway. That's not the point. Whatever the Secret Service is, whoever they're answering to, Treasury or Homeland, do they need agents? Do they need better planners? Is it impossible to do that venue, even though I think they've been doing the event since 28 and the venue there since the 60s, but we've never had this type of threat. And I just wonder how many other threats we've had that we don't know about that don't get as close. I want to give them full credit for the courage they showed, the organization under fire, but could they have done other stuff better? Here's Senator John Fetterman, cut nine.
I never really had an issue with the ballroom before all that, but clearly what happened there, I can't imagine why we can't just agree. Like, look, I don't have to love everything about it. You know, we do need that kind of a facility. And, you know, the president may not even be in office when it's even finished.
So that's the point. He's building it for his legacy. He's building it for the next guy. But, you know, there's a lot of people out there who are having fun with all this. Jimmy Kimmel, nobody's fun pro-shooting except for maybe some of these crazy podcasters. But Jimmy Kimmel made a joke on Thursday that the first lady called out. Now, this is the thing. You will have that person in your life that never gets mad, always level-headed, nothing insults them. But when they get insulted and they get mad, you think, oh, my goodness, what just happened? That's what happened with the first lady. Basically calling on, saying that Jimmy Kimmel should not be allowed on ABC because of this. Because of these comments that he made on Thursday when he pretended to be the host of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Cup 52.
Our First Lady Melania is here. Look at Melania. So beautiful. Mrs. Trump, you have a glow like an expectant widow.
Yeah, they laughed. So Melania went off, posted it online. President followed up, probably didn't know about it ahead of time. So what, as usual, his ratings go up and everyone's watching to see if he will apologize or if ABC is going to fire him. Here it is, cut 50.
It was a very light roast joke about the fact that he's almost 80 and she's younger than I am. It was not, by any stretch of the definition, a call to assassination. And they know that. I've been very vocal for many years speaking out against gun violence in particular. I am sorry that you and the president and everyone in that room on Saturday went through that. I really am. Just because no one got killed doesn't mean it wasn't traumatic and scary. And we should come together and be best. We really should.
Yeah, again, mocking him. So not only not an apology, enjoying the fact that it bothers the White House. Cut 51.
But I understand that the First Lady had a stressful experience over the weekend, and probably every weekend is pretty stressful in that house. And also, I agree that hateful and violent rhetoric is something we should reject. I do, and I think a great place to start to dial that back would be to have a conversation with your husband about it.
Right. You know, his ratings, I looked it up, 2-1 to 2-5. You know, Greg's like a 4-3-8, 4-5. Johnny Carson's was like a 6 or a 7. I mean, like 7 or 8. And then Leno's like 5.6 to 6, I think. So the whole thing's cratering out. And there's a lot to do with the fact that it's not entertainment anymore. David Axelrod posted this. I like Jimmy Kimmel. He's funny and courageous. And at a time when there's been too much cowardice, that is, when there's time that's been too much cowardice, that is, that said, this was a tasteless joke. The White House will use any issue to demand he be fired. His satire touches a nerve, and ABC is right to resist, but he would be right to apologize. Absolutely. And I also thought Bruce Springsteen had a similar comment. I thought Bruce Springsteen, who has been so negative towards the president, you can't be any more crazy outside Rosie O'Donnell. And he went out and quickly said, not condemning the violence, and said a prayer for the president, I guess, on stage. Whatever. Not going to listen to his music anyway. Never been a big Bruce fan. Many of you are. But that's the right thing to do. All right. When we come back, I'm going to go inside the wealth tax. The wealth tax out in California that's getting guys like Mark Zuckerberg and Steven Spielberg to leave the state. And a wealth tax here mocking the wealthy for not paying enough taxes. I'm going to bring the reality of it and what it could mean in New York City as well as New York State. As Ken Griffin of Citadel, one of the richest people in the country, was mocked by the mayor, one of the biggest socialist communists in the country, and they're not backing down. We'll give you the latest on this and what it means. If Ken Griffin leads, so does his $6 billion office project also leave, with all the people he was going to hire and all the charities that he supports. Is that all right for the socialists? Is that okay with you? Back in a moment.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
When I ran for mayor, I said I was going to tax the rich. Well, today, we're taxing the rich. I'm thrilled to announce we've secured a pied-à-terre tax, the first in New York's history. This is an annual fee on luxury properties worth more than $5 million, whose owners do not live full-time in the city. Like for this penthouse, which hedge fund CEO Ken Griffin bought for $238 million. This pied-à-terre tax is specifically designed for the richest of the rich, those who store their wealth in New York City real estate, but who don't actually live here. But even so, they're able to reap the huge financial rewards of owning property in, dare I say, the greatest city in the world.
So Pierre DeBoss joins us now, managing partner of Romer DeBoss. Pierre, this is damn it. You in New York, you live here, you work here, you want New York to do well. How much damage did that ad do?
You know, the rhetoric is beyond damaging to the future of the city, and it's evident in Ken Griffin's response. His immediate response was, keep up this rhetoric. We're going to take our plans for a $6 billion building we're building in the middle of Manhattan on Park Avenue for our company. We're going to relocate those employees to a different market, and the city will lose out on how many thousands of jobs of an economic stimulus would a construction project of that magnitude provide. And also, Ken Griffin runs one of the most arguably largest hedge fund in the world. How many billions of dollars of income tax revenue does the city derive from his company and all of its employees? So when you have this rhetoric of, I'm going to go tax the rich, and you have a personal attack against the guy in front of his own home, you're really, you know, you're doing the opposite of what you should be doing. You should be working with these people to just discuss how we can create economic stimulus for the city and how we can expand the economy, not just tax the rich and push people out.
But what I loved about this is because you no longer have to be a real estate expert to understand the philosophy difference. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, man, how did Ken Griffin get so successful?
Right.
Man, what has he done? How much does he give to charity?
Sure.
What buildings does he have? Do you think he stole it from people? Right. Or do you think he earned it? How many 90-hour work weeks did he have? How many games did he miss? How many back-to-school nights was he unable to attend in order to achieve this type of wealth? Right. And then how many people did he employ? How many people did he mentor?
Sure.
But then you have somebody who thinks he's the bad guy.
Right. Well, that's the thing. It all goes – and the shame of this stunt is that it's a social media publicity play, right?
But it goes with his philosophy.
It does go with his philosophy, but you know the biggest problem here is that the pied a terre tax, right? That's what he's bragging about.
What is that?
So the pied a terre tax is a tax they want to. It's basically a wealth tax for all intents and purposes. And what they want to do is that every apartment that's occupied as a second home in New York City above $5 million pays an annual tax to the city for being a second home owner that doesn't live here full time. Bear in mind, if you don't live here full time, your kids aren't in public schools. You're not taxing the system. You're not burdening our infrastructure. But the issue is those people are paying property taxes on significant property taxes. They're paying maintenance. They are providing, you know, increased demand and appreciation in real estate and jobs, right? But you want to say, okay, I'm going to go tax the rich. Here's how we got to this point. He ran on, I'm going to tax the rich, starting off with increase of income tax. Remember, Brian, you're talking about it's a rounding error for those making above $1 million. You know, it's only an extra $20,000. And then I'm going to increase corporate taxes. Very lofty expectations. Hochul luckily had some common sense to say, okay, we're not going to do this because we can't afford to push people out to this extent.
So they're having an emergency meeting?
Griffin's having a meeting with her on Thursday. But the point I wanted to make is that when you have those aspirations, they both were shot down. This pied a terre tax is low-hanging fruit. This is just saying, okay, I'm taxing the rich. What are you really taxing, though? They're estimating that this may raise about $500 million, right, which is probably grossly exaggerated. But let's just say it's true for a second. The city deficit's $5 billion. So you get to say, hey, I'm taxing the rich. You're not moving the needle much. You're not accomplishing much. What are you hurting, right? Like, you have to look at these policies and say, all right, well, I'm getting $500 million, right? I still have $4.5 billion to go before I have a balanced budget. You can't balance it without cutting spending. And then what are the negatives of taxing the rich, which you're seeing with Ken Griffin? What if Ken Griffin actually picks up and leaves? What
if
Citadel? He might. How many millions upon millions of dollars or billions of dollars over the course of time are you losing in tax revenue? So yes, you got the TikTok video. You got to say, I'm taxing the rich. Most of society or voter base fell for it. It's a publicity stunt. In reality, the long-term impacts can be far more negative than positive.
Right. So if you look at right now, the top 1% pay 40% of all the revenue tax in the country. The top 10% pay 72%. Mm-hmm. The top 25% pay 87.2% of the taxes. You look at this and you go, well, the problem is successful people aren't paying enough taxes.
Right.
Are you crazy?
Right.
You have to say, what does it take to grow the tax base? They don't believe in our system.
Right.
And what does Ken Griffin do? When you have a $6 billion building, don't you hire people?
Yeah.
Do they have families? Do they go to school? Mm-hmm. Do they go to restaurants?
Mm-hmm.
Do they go to gyms?
Right.
I mean, so he might not do this. I actually, even though I like the city, I think the city needs to learn a lesson.
Yeah.
I hope he picks up and doesn't do it.
I
hope he leaves.
I know. Elections have consequences. And, you know, as a New York City resident and business owner myself, I would hate to see that happen. But I think people need to really see a lesson that you can't just believe in this, you know, theoretical rhetoric of socialism. Socialism's take, spend, deficit increases. It doesn't work. This is a financial capital world. It is, no matter what you do, it is one of the 10 most expensive places on the universe.
Right.
It's always going to be that way. The only way to create more of an equitable system and to combat affordability is to incentivize economic development. And that's the flaw in this. You have to be incentivizing developers. And developers are going to be incentivized if they have the ability to make money, which only comes on the higher end real estate. If you can tie that towards affordable housing requirements, you can create inventory, you can create supply, you can combat affordability that way. This doesn't combat anything. This is just pure lunacy.
Pierre, are you solely working in New York City or other places?
No. We represent our high-end residential market is in New York City and the Hamptons. And our commercial market is all throughout the country.
Gotcha.
So we're representing more people purchasing and selling real estate.
What about housing costs? What are they going? Are they going up or down?
They're only going up because of the supply issue. Rents continue to go up at laughable measures. Rents in New York City have become a joke. And that's not ending because there's no additional supply being created. And that's your problem. You know, the housing cost, I don't foresee that changing anytime soon.
So if you look at the wealth tax and what it does, I just asked to find out who is left. In California, they're trying to pass a wealth tax.
Right.
Elon Musk is gone. Peter Thiel is gone. Joe Lonsdale is gone. David Sachs is gone. Larry Page is gone. Sergey Brin is leaving.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Steven Spielberg, who is gone. They're rich. But when you start vilifying them and try to take 40, 50, 55, 60% of their income,
right, right.
They're not dumb.
Right.
So this is really a significant time right now, mm-hmm. as we get ready for an election. Who are you voting for?
Right, right. Well, this is exactly what we're saying. You know, here's the consequence of voting for a 34-year-old who, quite frankly, didn't have the requisite experience to run the most important city in the world. And more importantly, he's more of a focus on, you know, funny TikTok videos that appease people than, you know, an actual economic plan. Where's your economic plan? Where's your plan to create more jobs? Where's your plan to create more housing? Where's your plan to combat affordability? You can't just run on the rhetoric of taxing the rich. Again, like I was describing, this tax is barely going to move the needle. What are you do with the rest of the $4.5 billion deficit?
Right.
What do you do with it?
So I see it personally, just anecdotal, a lot of empty commercial real estate. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of empty buildings. Mm-hmm. What's the reality? How much vacancy do you have?
Well, you know, the office market's rebounded, which is good because COVID was catastrophic, obviously, for the office market throughout the country. You are seeing a significant rebound for demand. It's not pandemic levels, but it's the healthiest it's been since the pandemic. Retail in New York City is doing well. You know, prices of small box retail have come down, which has helped increase demand and small businesses entering the marketplace. And, you know, our population's only grown. So I do think, you know, look, the office market is going to, there's a whole new world for the office market.
Retail.
You know, it's funny. I always use this example on Lexington between 58th and 59th. That corridor, which was like the Gap, Victoria's Secret, Aldo, it has been vacant for 5 years, the entire street. And it's across from the Bloomberg building. This is prime New York City retail space. I mean, you know,
Does it worry you?
It does worry me because I think that businesses, you know, see the anti-business sentiment of the city and like, well, why do we want to expand in New York City? Why do we want to pay all these onerous fees and taxes? And why not go into other markets as opposed to investing here where there's greater opportunity and upside elsewhere?
Right. And we're seeing it. Remember, we had Jamie Dimon on last week. He reminded me, too, more people are in Dallas than New York City, even though he built this beautiful building on 47th.
That's the thing, Brian. Like, people don't realize that. They just see this massive skyscraper, which is one of the most beautiful office buildings in the world. Right. They don't realize Jamie Dimon's footprint actually reduced.
Pierre DeBoss, thanks so much.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back. In studio on her day off, Chandler Painter, Fox News anchor, we all know her, love her. And Chandler, you were just reminding me, you were on. You had to scramble to get on the White House Correspondents' Dinner when it went from an event to a news breaking situation.
It was probably the most urgent breaking news situation since I've worked here. That's what I'm usually on standby all night for.
Were we upstreaming it?
We were not. We were minutes away from it, though.
Okay.
So I wasn't even on the clock yet. I started at 9 p.m. And so I'm still in hair and makeup at like 8:30.
Right.
And I get a call from the producer, get in the chair right now. Shots fired, White House, and I say, I got to go. I didn't have my complete makeup on, and I run to, you know, here at work, there's multiple elevators you have to get on to get to a certain studio, right? So I'm just running out of the chair. I'm dropping things on my way to the studio.
And you have no information yet.
No information. I know nothing but shots fired.
Wow.
And so, as I'm on my way to the chair, the makeup artist is like running after me, picking up things I'm dropping. I get in the chair and I go, okay, what do we know? They're like, we know nothing. Just shots fired. We think there's someone in custody. We're trying to get someone on the phone for you right now. Go.
And it was okay.
And I go, okay, this is a Fox News alert.
And then
shots fired at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. We believe someone's in custody. They say, John Roberts. On the phone now. So I'm like, let's go to John Roberts, who's in the, and then he took over and it was a lot.
Wow. He was right next to me.
He was.
He was in the table right across from me. So he called you from the room.
He did. So that was, it was really, we took all the viewers into the room in that moment. So John Roberts is on the phone. Right. Cell service isn't fantastic, as you know, because everyone was using their cell phones. And he starts describing what they heard, what they saw. We don't know really anything confirmed of what happened. And so he takes over talking. And then I guess Brett Baer was nearby and Brett Baer took over the phone and he started describing what he heard and what he saw. So we did that. I was on for about 20 minutes and then Kevin Cork took over and all night long we were live it was a different, you know, anchor taking over every.
Wow. It was just crazy. And that's why Saturday was a lot different than everything changed on Sunday.
Right.
Did our show live on Sunday night.
Sure.
But that's one of the things you got to do on a daily, on a regular basis. Be ready, right?
That's right.
How many times do you think that's happened?
For
how long have you been at Fox?
I've been here 2 years now.
So how many times do you think it's happened when there's breaking news?
It happens every and a lot on the weekend. Unfortunately, I work the weekends overnight, and a lot of breaking news on Saturday nights, it seems.
Right.
Lately, at least. The last time I was rushed to the chair was when we captured Maduro, and I had to be there right then. It was like 1:30 in the morning, and I'm like, oh, okay, go, go, go. And again, we didn't know any information, so I'm just having to say, people on the ground see fire. They hear explosions. We don't know what's happening. We're trying to find out. Still time. We're alive. Go.
And that's go. And do you find that fun?
I do. Now, in the moment, you don't have time to really think about it. Just like, go now and do it.
So this is just give everybody an idea of your background. You were a lawyer.
Yes, I was.
I mean, you never stopped
being
a lawyer.
I still keep all my you know, license fresh. And
right. So how long were you a lawyer?
I practiced law for about 5 years, was a deputy prosecutor in Arkansas, rural Arkansas, before I took my resume to the local news director and said, hey, I want to try TV. If you need someone, I'm available, legal analyst, whatever you may need. I didn't hear from him for months. And finally, there was a big trial, a murder trial in Arkansas. He called me the Friday before and said, would you sit with our reporter on Monday and offer analysis during this trial? And that started it all. I had to.
You like it? You liked it right away?
Of course. I did my first live shot. It was a Monday during the noon show about jury selection. And something just really clicked. And I said, this is what I want to do.
Right. And then when did you went from legal? How did you go from legal analyst to everything?
So I did that trial for the week. I really enjoyed, you know, there weren't cameras in the courtroom, so we could explain what was happening inside the court to people. It was a big trial. A realtor was kidnapped and murdered. And so from there, I had to choose, actually, if I was going to continue being a prosecutor or do television, because my elected boss was, I can't do both.
Right, right.
So my immediate boss, who always supported what I wanted to do, said, you could always be a prosecutor. No matter how old you are, you can always come back and do this. Go see where TV leads. So I quit my job. Great benefits, of course, and great pay to go get paid nothing in local news.
Right.
And I freelanced for 2 years and whatever came open. So the first opportunity I had in local news was to fill in the early morning 2 a.m. shift for the meteorologist who had just had a baby. So she was gone for 3 months. And she would do the morning fun live shots. She would go and play with the soccer team. She would go to the new restaurant opening, the county fair, down the water slide. So that's what I did for 3 months to learn how to be live on TV. And were the fun live shots, interviewing and doing activities.
And did you like all that?
I loved it.
Yeah.
It was fun. It fit my personality. And from there, the news director was like, okay, we have an opening during our dayside shift. You have to pitch a story. You have to do this. So slowly but surely, over 2 years, I learned how to be
a reporter.
And he said, I can't hire you full time unless you know how to work the camera. Edit your stories. Yeah. It'd be an MMJ because that's the only position that was open.
Yeah.
And so finally I learned, I would go on my days off and shadow the photographers, the camera people, the gear, and to learn all of that.
And do you like that part of it, the edit part?
I did like the editing part of this, and it was hard work, Brian. When I was hired as MMJ, I'm by myself all day. I have 3 to 4 different stories that I'm driving myself to around the state of Arkansas to try to get in before 3 o'clock in the afternoon so that they could all make air.
Yeah, and because you got to go edit it.
Yes, I had to go edit it. And it had to be in on time. Plus, I was live by the 4 o'clock show.
And so the piece is
not only
did
I have to turn it in. Right. And sometimes they're shorter. You do the longer stories, the shorter stories. Yeah. It was hard work for about 10 months, and then finally Court TV called and rescued me.
Right.
And then I went to Atlanta, Georgia, and worked for Court TV.
And then you ended up here.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
That's a quick journey. How many years was that?
It was about 10 years.
Oh, it was 10?
Yeah, it's about 10 years altogether.
And knowing that back, you could be making so much more money, as a lawyer.
When I was hired as an MMJ in local news, I was making a third of what I made as an attorney.
Wow. And what does your family think about
this? Of course, they're so supportive, very proud. I grew up watching Fox News, and it was a Fox News home. News was always on in the background of my home.
Right.
So I've been watching it for years.
Okay.
That's good. And Chanley Painter's here right now. And we were just talking about the breaking news over the weekend. Yes. And now, what does the rest of your week look like?
So this is my quote-unquote weekend. I go in Wednesdays overnight to Sunday mornings. And like I said, I started the evening shows and right. worked my way to your morning
shows.
You
know, Ainsley, yeah. Well, Ainsley, that's where she started.
Yes, she did. Yes, yeah, she did it for like 8 years. It's a tough schedule because I never sleep. I just nap when I can.
But aren't you also into the martial arts?
I love martial arts. Very good exercise. I actually began because I was interested in self-defense.
Right.
So I started in college with the self-defense class. And you just keep going. It's great. Yeah, like I said, it's great exercise.
What discipline do you study?
So this was a Grandmaster Han's Young Ma Ru. It's Korean-based kind of conglomerate of high-level training techniques from jujitsu, karate, taekwondo, and then right. the Young Ma form.
So it's kind of a hybrid.
Right, it is. It is.
So if someone in the city, if you're on a subway, grabs your arm, would it be instinctive how
elbow
you
strike
reacted?
Immediately.
Would you even think about it?
Probably not. I probably, you know, I try to give people the benefit of the doubt, but I'm not in the South anymore. I'm in New York City, so I can't do that.
So,
you know, I'm raised to be from the South, be very polite, and, you know, smile, and you can't do that in New York City.
Yeah.
Don't make eye contact on the subway. I've learned that.
Right. Yeah. We don't want you happy.
No.
That's the last thing we want.
In fact, I've learned to look miserable walking down the street.
So I was reading, I'll never forget the first time I realized this, New York has always been like that. I'm reading Dave McCullough's book on John Adams.
Mm-hmm.
And John Adams, by carriage, comes into New York City.
Yes.
And he said, what is with this place? Everyone is so rude and in a rush.
Yes.
You're talking about 1770. You
right.
know?
It hasn't changed a bit. Hasn't changed. And I've turned into one of those people. I walked on the sidewalk. And this, where we work, is a very kind of touristy area, as you know.
Absolutely.
So there's lots of people who are just sightseeing. They're taking their time. They're taking up my sidewalk that I need to walk down in a hurry.
So you're angry.
I am. I will sometimes say, you know, move. You have to be mean, which that's mean for me.
That's mean for you? Move.
Like, move. But quit blocking the walkway.
Have you ever felt threatened?
You know, actually, I haven't. The 2 years that I've been here, I've not. Sometimes, you know, I do walk to work. In the middle of the night, sometimes I come in 2 a.m., 3 a.m. on Thursday mornings. But the great thing about Fox, which mm-hmm. I've heard you brag about them too, is our security team.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And so they will actually help walk me in the morning if it's the time that I feel unsafe.
So let's talk a little bit about the shooter and some of the charges against him.
Yes.
Here's what Jonathan Turley, of course, from the White House Correspondents' Dinner, said yesterday, cut four.
This was a highly functioning individual. This is not someone who's going to be able to make an insanity defense. This is someone who did a calculated and nearly successful effort to enter that room. And it didn't just happen in a vacuum. You know, many of the things on his manifesto are statements that are come close to those I quote in my book, coming from politicians.
Yeah, Days of Rage is the name of his book. And he's, as you know, he's an esteemed attorney and a professor.
Yes.
So you're right. If he does insanity, not going to work.
It's not going to work. This is, I don't know if I could have planned and done something like this myself. I mean, this was a very calculated, planned out, his transportation, the weapons that he was able to bring with him, his way that he maneuvered in a hotel that he had to have been familiar with. And his manifesto, well written. He's obviously a very smart individual. And the thing about the insanity plea is, even if someone thought they were running into a space to save the world from aliens, that person knew right from wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it comes down to. I've covered many trials across the nation at Court TV where people tried to plead the insanity. There was one, a young girl who murdered her mother. She had four mental health experts come into a courtroom in front of the jury and say she was mentally insane at the time. She did not know right from wrong. Four, not one, four. They still convicted her and sent her to prison for the rest of her life. So this is a very tough defense to mount.
Right.
And for someone to show that they planned it out, that the person tried to run or wrote about it, knew what they were doing was wrong. I think in his manifesto, he even says, I'm willing to take out other people who are innocent.
Yes.
In this to achieve this goal.
Which was to kill this cabinet and kill
exactly.
Trump.
Exactly.
So it's all there. So it's not even, so if it defends you, might just throw yourself on the mercy of the court.
Well, yeah.
But you're going to fight it out and you're going to delay.
For me, he can either make the government prove it up, which is his right. But I could see them trying to plead to something less than life because he's facing up to life.
Here's what the president said. Cut five.
I read a manifesto. He's radicalized. He was a Christian, a believer, and then he became an anti-Christian, and he had a lot of change. He's been going through a lot based on what he wrote. His brother complained about him, and I think reported him to the police, and his sister likewise complained about him. His family was very concerned. He was probably a pretty sick guy.
Yeah, but no signs of it, we don't think. But they said in 2024, things started to change for him, which we're here in 2026.
Right.
These guys get so incensed.
Right.
What is it with the strategy to delay? Luigi Mangione in New York.
Yeah.
Now you have the kid, the very Charlie typical. Kirk shooter.
Yeah.
So why is that? Why is the defense
very
to delay?
Brian Koberger, he maintained his innocence for years until the very last second and then pled guilty to everything. So it is typical strategy for a defense and for a defendant because they know that the case is strong against them. All they have, the only power, Brian, they have is to delay. And a good defense attorney is going to make sure that they do everything along the way, which is all the annoying small motions along the way. Even for Mangione, we have these suppression hearings over evidence that clearly is admissible, but because they want to preserve an appeal or that they had effective assistance of counsel, they have to make all of these motions along the way, and it takes time.
No, I hear you. The other thing is the delay. Is it because jail is better than prison? Is
that could
jail
be also,
better conditions?
Some people like, you know, especially in federal court, I hear federal prison's better than jail, especially in New York, right?
Oh,
so
yeah,
some people are like, you know, prison's a little, you know, you have more privileges than in a state prison.
See, if I see a guy with tattoos all over, ripped jeans jacket, 20 prior arrests, and they go into jail, like, okay, this is a criminal system. What about these guys that kill for the first time? I mean, we assume.
Right.
You know,
no
the
criminal
guy,
history.
You know, the no criminal history, Luigi Mangione, this guy, Charlie Kirk's killer, Crooks, if he had survived. I mean, what that mindset, at one point, do they almost sober up and say, what do I did? Do you ever check back with these guys?
Sure, absolutely. Well, we know the Gilgal Beach serial killer agreed as part of his plea to cooperate with the FBI behavioral unit. So they can study him. They can figure out. And he was one, to his credit, who didn't delay. He went ahead and copped the plea, right? Instead of making this go out even longer than it could have.
And he was living, while killing these women, he's living amongst us.
Living amongst us.
Living in suburban marriage.
Family, wife, child, and all the while and was able to get away with it for so long because, you know, thankfully our technology has advanced more now where we can catch these guys a little bit sooner. But did you see where Luigi Mangione's team had to put out a statement this morning because everyone is pointing to, you know, Cole Allen and all these political, would be assassins and political violence and targeting politicians where Luigi Mangione's team says, look, he does not claim to be someone who targeted for political violence. He doesn't want anything to do with this. He condemns, get this, Brian, he condemns political violence, Luigi Mangione.
Yeah. That's insane.
What?
A few more minutes for Chantley Painter in a moment. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Chantley Painter here, Fox News anchor extraordinaire. We're just watching what's happening right now at the White House, Chantley.
Yeah.
Pretty cool, right? You
it's
got
really
the king,
cool.
got the
I
queen.
Love the pomp and circumstance.
Right. And now it's, you know, it's a very ceremonial. He's now shaking hands with the whole cabinet. And then tonight there'll be a state dinner. And there's a celebration.
I did not get invited. I'm
know,
so disappointed.
But Martha Callum will be there. I think Ainsley will be there.
Yes. Love it.
But you know, you just pointed out something pretty important. They're celebrating that we won.
I know. I thought this was odd that they're traveling over here for a state visit to celebrate the 250 years of losing the New World.
Right. They graduated. Then they came back and fought
us again.
Good for
them. You know, they're not sore losers.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I was in the White House and they pointed to me the area that is, the burn marks are still there from 1814.
Oh, wow.
When they burned the White House.
I love history. That's one of the things that I love about you. You love history as well. I love history. And so this, to me, anything that we can celebrate or look back and learn more about where we've been is fascinating.
I have a book coming out called Uniting the States coming out in the fall, right? So we're doing a special for it. So you would have loved to be where I was Saturday.
Yes.
The Smithsonian.
Yes.
And at the American portion of the Smithsonian.
Right.
It's just fantastic. I mean, you have Washington's uniform there. You see the original cannonballs.
Yes.
You see the flag that was flying at Fort McHenry that Francis Scott Key saw.
Right.
During the national anthem.
Right. I remember when I visited D.C. for the first time with my family, we went to Ford Theater, and you could see like a strand of Lincoln's hair is down in the basement where the museum part is.
Right.
It was just,
and they got the gun. Did you see the gun?
I probably did. I was really young, but just growing up, I'm thankful my family, we would always go in our Astro van to sites, historic battlefields, and along the way.
Really?
And I'm the one standing there going, this is what happened, this general, this is, So
you love that.
I love it. Even today, if I can go on any trip where I'm learning something, and I went to Stonehenge a few months ago, I'm standing in 5,000-year-old history.
And you just love it.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. We have that in common, too. All right. So, Chandler, when's the next time we can see you on TV?
So I will be on with my weekend now. So Thursday morning on your show.
All right, great. So Thursday on Fox and Friends.
Yes.
Chandler Page
will
be there.
Yes.
And so will some other people, but Chandler's the only important
one. That's all they need to worry about. Thanks, Brian.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade. Welcome to another hour of the show. Hope you like it. I know you will. Roy K. Altman's going to be with us. He's the author of a new book, Israel on Trial, Examining the History, the Evidence, and the Law. And Selena Zito is standing by. We're watching the pomp and circumstances, literally, of the British king and queen here. The president's making his remarks. A lot of fife playing, a lot of colonists talk, a lot of redcoats on the front lawn. Which hasn't happened really since 1814. So this time there's no threat, but the President of the United States is having a good time. And I think it's an important time for the relationship. Let's bring in Selena Zito now. Selena, you, of course, syndicated columnist, Washington Examiner, national political reporter, and author of Butler, The Untold Story of the Near Assassination of Donald Trump and the Fight for America's Heartland. Selena, this is one of those meetings where it's not just ceremonial. If the king wants to do his job, he's going to start to, he has to start, healing relations between the countries, don't you think?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. And I think it's the best way to, the best steps to do that is a relationship between President Trump and King Charles. I think they have always had an amicable relationship, and they both have mutual respect for what each wants to accomplish. And, they both sort of came up in that same era, right? 70s, 80s, where the culture was changing, where the world was changing. And so they have that sort of cultural connection as well. I once met King Charles when he was Prince Charles in an alley in Pittsburgh when he was coming into a couple cities across the country, former steel cities that were trying to remake themselves. I didn't know he was going to be in town. It wasn't the age of, sort of the internet, right? Like you knew everything. And I was just taking a shortcut, walking with my newborn through an alley, and he was getting out of his car.
And? Nice guy?
It was very nice. I knew the mayor, so the mayor sort of felt obligated of introducing me, but I was just so embarrassed that I found myself in that place. But he was very gracious.
So, you talk about the relations between these two countries, Starmer's fighting for his political life. And I don't know, I've been watching some of this. I don't know if he's going to survive. So this will be, they've had like six prime ministers in the last 5 years.
Right. And when do we see these kinds of events happen? And Brian, you are a student of history. When we see great turmoil politically, that means that there's great turmoil in our culture, in our economy. You look at the our country, for example, during the Industrial Revolution, we switched House majorities by 100 seats every 2 years. Presidents didn't last longer than one term. And so I think we are in the same sort of turmoil. You look at our turmoil in terms of switching majorities in the House and the Senate, the presidency sort of, you know, going from one side to the other and back to the other side. And that has to do with our technological revolution, right? It's sort of like the Industrial Revolution. Things are changing, and our politics is always downstream of culture. It's changing as well. So yes, that's my really long answer, is saying he's facing those same problems.
So you're there in Butler. You interviewed the president at the time. He helps you out, gives you perspective on his book. And we're at it again. Butler, there was a shell of a Secret Service team, most of them with Jill Biden. And, you know, you don't know even how organized they actually were. No coordination with locals. This is different. He's a president now, a president that's already had, already know that he's under threat. So what's your takeaway from what we now know 3 days later?
So I think two things happen. I think the Secret Service, and you were there in the room, and I was right beside him in Butler. You saw the people around him act quickly, right? They were there. They were, but the planning, right? The things that go around the event, that is what I think we really need to look into. Well, you know, I've gone to the White House Correspondents' Dinner a couple of times. You made a really good point. Like, if you had big thighs, you've got a problem, right? Because everybody's knees are touching. Like, it's so cramped. And so why? I know how he is. I know his insistence if he wants to do something. It's sort of like I was watching in Butler when he kept insisting to put his shoes on. And I don't think a lot of people know that he wanted to go back out at that rally in Butler. He wanted to go back out, just like he wanted to go back at the correspondents' dinner. And I think this is a character thing that people don't understand. He told me, and it's in the book, Butler, he told me the next day, look, I wasn't Donald Trump in that moment. My job right then is representing the entire presidency and legacy of the presidency of the United States. We are supposed to show strength, that we endure, that things don't knock us down. And I'm sure he was thinking the exact same thing Saturday night.
Yeah. And then we still have to maybe button things up. Susie Wiles had an emergency meeting yesterday, and they made it sound kind of generic and informational, but I think she was very upset. And I think the family, the Trump family's upset too. They don't feel as though that perimeter was properly guarded.
I don't disagree with you. And I'm sure Susie is upset because she was there in Butler, right? This is the second time she has gone through this. And I know how I feel, right? Like, what, hearing those, the sounds of those bullets. I mean, I'm a gun owner. I go target shooting all the time. Bullet sounds don't bother me. In that kind of situation, it's completely different. So I can't even imagine how she felt. Well, no, I can't imagine how she felt in that moment. And she's going to make sure that something changes.
Yeah, here's what Caroline Levitt said. Cut eight.
I definitely wouldn't say changes are out of the question. I think, again, that it's up to the White House here, and we view it as a great responsibility to ensure the maximum safety of the president and the vice president and the entire cabinet. And so we're always looking for ways to improve security. I think if you just sit here and say everything is perfect all the time, that's not a good way to operate. And so the White House will continue to engage with DHS and with Secret Service to find ways to improve and strengthen security. But as far as Saturday night is concerned, the president was satisfied with the response.
Yeah, they got. Do you notice how quick they got JD out compared to the president, though? Right?
Yeah, yeah, I did see that. Although, weren't there? Now, I've looked at different angles. Didn't some men immediately stand in front of him at the stage? Weren't people standing in front of him as well as ushering him out? It's hard. It's sort of hard to get, you know, a 360 angle, but that's what it seems like. You know, they grabbed JD like he was 8 years old by the collar and dragged him out. Right.
That's true. And I don't know why they were both there. I mean, they got to rethink that too, because I've been to about 10 of them. I've never
seen. I don't disagree with you. You talk to the president a lot. I talk to the president a lot. I think there's a conflict, inner conflict with him because he loves his detail that's around him. He feels safe. He feels confident. He feels that they are competent and have his back.
And Sean Curran, right? Sean Curran is his guy.
Right. But the conflict lies in planning, right? Well, you shouldn't have JD or the vice president and president in the same room. You shouldn't be in a room that's that vulnerable and that closed in and not a lot of ways to escape, right? Look around you at your exits when you were there, Brian. Did you see, like, it is almost suffocating the way you feel.
It really is. Yeah, no, you really can't walk between. I wasn't kidding. I was going up to a bunch of strangers as usual because I was the last one in. Excuse me. And then you finally get in your seat because I knew I'm going to wait till the last minute because once you get in your seat, you can't move. There's 2,200 people there. And I thought to myself, what a fire hazard. I'm just glad that nobody panicked. If everyone panicked and started running for the exits, for example, if those people running in were gunmen as opposed to security, there would have been justified panic. I mean, it would have been carnage. But I want to bring you to a story you may or may not have seen. Did you see the story in The Atlantic?
Which one? What did they do this time?
The Pentagon may not be telling Donald Trump the full picture about the war. And it has anonymous figures in J.D. Vance's staff who say that Pete Hegseth is not telling him the whole truth about the war. And some of the facts there are absolutely impossible. They're saying that 2/3 of his Air Force is still afloat, as is most of the, you know, 1/3 of his Navy. Now, the Mosquito Navy, I get it. But the stuff in here looks like the vice president's staff, unless they totally made it out of a whole cloth, is informing against Pete. Is there a problem inside the White House between the Dan Driscoll, Pete Hegseth, and J.D. Vance crowd?
Well, historically, you know that vice president's offices, not necessarily vice president's, but their offices are thinking about the next election, right? And they're protecting their asset, which is the vice president politically. And so it's not unbelievable that there would be a leak like this. Although I'm very skeptical of something that goes into The Atlantic.
Well, they were out to get Trump. We know about the signal chat and all that.
Right. And they're trying to, you know, create division. So they can't create division within the conservative populist movement. It doesn't move. So let's create a division between the vice president and the president. That is certainly not out the realm of possibility that what's going on here.
But so you think that quote might not have been a quote at all?
Yeah.
Wow, that would be beyond evil and irresponsible. I want to talk about Iran, if we could. Marco Rubio, on the latest offer, they say they'll open up the strait if we get rid of the blockade. Cut 27.
Reports do indicate Iran has offered to open the straits, but they want to delay conversations about their nuclear program. Would this be acceptable to the Trump administration?
Well, again, I'm not going to speculate about the president's decision making on this matter. Suffice it to say that the nuclear question is the reason why we're in this in the first place. If Iran was just a radical country run by radical people, but, you know, it'd still be a problem. But they are revolutionary. In essence, they seek to expand and export their revolution, not just what they do in Iran. That's why they're with Hezbollah in Lebanon. That's why they've supported Hamas. That's why they've supported the militias in Iraq. They don't just seek to dominate Iran. They seek to dominate the region. And imagine that with a nuclear weapon.
So that's, you know, Marco Rubio is the real great explainer on that staff.
Yeah, absolutely. That was completely on point. Iraq, and I would even argue that Iran wants to dominate the world, not just the region. They want to not only be the dominant force in the Middle East, but they want to create suspicion and disruption throughout the world so that they, and that's sort of their sense of power. There's no reason to trust them to do anything. If they say, well, we'll do this if you do that, of course the president is going to say, yeah, that's not happening. We're just not going to talk until you come back and you do something, right? He wants evidence-based actions from Iran.
So I want you to hear what Friedrich Merz played, the Chancellor of Germany, through a translator. I could not believe this statement. Cut 33.
At the moment, I cannot see what strategic exit the Americans are now opting for, especially as the Iranians are obviously negotiating very skillfully, or rather very skillfully not negotiating and letting the Americans travel to Islamabad, only to leave again without any results. This entire nation is being humiliated by the Iranian state leadership, especially by these so-called Revolutionary Guards.
Your thoughts? How about he thinks we're being humiliated, and for him to say that?
That's a really good example of someone that lives in a bubble and is surrounded by people telling him that's what's going on. I don't think the United States is being humiliated. I think there's a lot of things that we don't know that's going on. A lot of negotiations that are plans that are being made. I'm not being a cheerleader for the president, but I am being. I do understand his mindset and the mindset of the people that he trusts the most, such as Marco Rubio and his son-in-law and Steve. And I think that in the end, whenever the end is, and I suspect the end won't be long from now, I think people will say, man, we caught that wrong.
I hear you. I thoroughly agree. And that's why I take notes of people who jump off the ship when things get tough, as opposed to just being an analyst. You don't have to be a cheerleader. Just be an analyst. And for them to, as a NATO member, do nothing, know that we do the majority of defending, and for them to say something. If you want to say that behind the scenes, I get it. Maybe it leaks out inadvertently. But for him to do that publicly, they say it's now in the leader's interest to be anti-Trump in the region. So you look like a tough guy.
We have to ask ourselves, we have to be reflective. Okay, why are you trying to undermine the United States? What's your end goal?
If you're Merz?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Your end goal is why you better build up your defense quick, because Trump's not going to forget where you were.
No, absolutely. He's not going to forget.
Selena Zito, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, and check out her columns online and with the Washington Examiner. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm keeping you up to date on what's happening at the White House ceremony. It's really cool, but there's no news happening. President made some nice remarks. The king didn't speak. Now the Marines are coming by. People are there. They're loving it. Don't move. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Big guests, bold opinions, better information. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Do you think that political violence is ever justified?
Yes, especially when the systems we have in place are not serving the people.
I do think that a lot of times their thought process to get to this type of violence is really justified, and that they just need to maybe express it better than killing people.
I think if an oppressed people are trying to escape that oppression, then I think that would be a situation where it's justified.
That's what the Black Panthers are doing. Like, it's not, like, they get to define the terms of violence. Like, when we loot from stores or we riot, that's considered violence. But them, like, pillaging Africa or pillaging, like, India or pillaging, like, other countries. So I think political violence is definitely a necessary step to, like, liberation.
So that is the younger people, a slice of life, man on the street.
In Washington Square Park, around NYU, but they don't identify, just 20-something.
The purple hair, nose ring crowd.
Yeah, they weren't as extreme looking, but I mean, that's just a small portion of it. Like, everyone essentially.
But isn't that Hassan Piker? He said basically it's okay to kill the CEO. You have to understand it. He said kill Rick Scott. He said I'd rather, he vilifies Republicans, said I'd rather vote for anybody in Hamas, let alone what you said about Israel. And that's one of the number one left-wing podcasters out there. You don't like someone, just kill them. You know, that's the attitude we used to think of, like street thugs and career criminals. Now you have people with master's degrees with that attitude.
They say the people who most agree with political violence are the most educated in this country.
Drop out of school before it's too late. Roy K. Altman will join us. Brand new book out. We'll put Israel in perspective. Don't move.
talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I was a little surprised to see the German chancellor use that word, though that feeling reflects the conversations I've had with world leaders over the last weeks without any question. This is a close and strong ally of the United States, at least historically. But the Europeans are so angry at the U.S. for having unilaterally entered this war, a war that is causing much more economic damage, energy damage, other issues for the Europeans than it is for the United States. And then Trump calls them cowards for not getting involved. So the emotions are raw. They're angry.
Yeah, that is Ian Bremmer. He's got a good global perspective, but tends to lean very anti-Trump these days, more of a traditional foreign relations guy. But we have the Israel and U.S. Taking out the one of the worst regimes in the world. North Korea arguably is worse, and then you got Russia. But they're more traditional, you know, traditional powers. Iran has not been dealt with, and we can go over the reasons why. I didn't think we'd have to, but so many people say the president didn't outline enough. I think that if you picked up a paper over the last 40 years, even if you don't have any much interest in foreign policy, you would understand the need to confront. But it looks as though Frederick Merz has come out, and he has said something that I think is so out of line. Here's the German chancellor through a translator talking about this war. Cut 33.
At the moment, I cannot see what strategic exit the Americans are now opting for, especially as the Iranians are obviously negotiating very skillfully, or rather very skillfully not negotiating and letting the Americans travel to Islamabad, only to leave again without any results. This entire nation is being humiliated by the Iranian state leadership, especially by these so-called Revolutionary Guards.
The entire, really? Being humiliated? Let's bring in Roy K. Altman. He's the author of a brand new book, Israel on Trial, Examining the History, the Evidence, and the Law. And right now, they are basically in a ceasefire with Lebanon, but not with Hezbollah. And we're waiting to see what the outcome is of this pause in Iran. Roy, what is your take on the Germans' take?
I just think he's obviously very angry that he's been shown to be a coward and hasn't come to the help and rescue of the United States, his close ally and benefactor. And I think he's just wrong on the facts. Anyone who's been following this war closely knows that there's never been a war like it. I was talking to an Israeli general who's a friend who said to me, Judge, just think about it. There's never been a war in history where within the first minute of the war, the head of state of the enemy and all of their top leaders and commanders were taken out. Napoleon never did it. Alexander didn't do it. Julius Caesar didn't do it. We're in totally uncharted territory. And many of these leaders are hiding underground. Mashtaba may himself already be dead. That's not super clear at this point. He's certainly incapacitated. And they're not really aware, very likely, of just the level of devastation of their missile arsenal, their nuclear program, which, of course, they've spent the last few decades building. Their Navy, their Air Force, totally in disarray. And now with the blockade, it may well be checkmate. Financial collapse looks like it's on the horizon.
Judge, I mean, obviously everything you said is beyond reproach. You didn't do any hyperbole. It's a fact. Everything you said is a fact. And what you're referring to is the fact the blockade is stopping them from moving any oil. And it's overflowing. They're running out of tankers to put it in, storage facilities to keep it in. And because of that, they're going to have to cap wells shortly. That is literally, the oil is their lifeblood. Sanctions and all, through the ghost ship, that's all been shut down. How people can't see that as part of the issues, that America doesn't know what to do, we're being humiliated. What are you talking about? We got a myriad of options, and we have continued to flood in with more military hardware and sophisticated defense and give our allies the same thing. Nothing's slowed down. We haven't pulled out and wondering how we're going to get the uranium out. Nothing's changed.
Not only that, but what has changed is the geostrategic situation in the Middle East. And I think it's short-sighted not to recognize that for the first time, maybe in history, the Arab Gulf states, saw and recognized and made clear in public what they had been making clear in many instances in private, which is that there is only one evil destabilizing regime in the Middle East, and it's not the Jewish state. It's another Muslim country, an evil regime in Tehran that must be dealt with. And they, not just the UAE, but Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and even Oman, are in talks with Israel to pipe oil away from the Strait of Hormuz, Bahrain, Kuwait as well, up to Israel, a revolutionary game changer that would change the face of the Middle East perhaps forever, linking Israel through oil and natural gas production in the Gulf states. And then you have what's happened in Lebanon and Syria. Inconceivable 1 year ago, let alone 3 or 5 years ago, that Israel invades southern Lebanon and the government of Lebanon and the government of adjoining Syria, far from blaming Israel, blame only one party, Iran, for having destabilized their region. And in fact, the Lebanese government has made the ambassador to Lebanon from Iran, before that was the person basically ruling the country, persona non grata in the country, and has vowed to disarm Hezbollah, something they haven't done since 1982. All of this happening because the United States and Israel stood shoulder to shoulder and used tremendous force to defend themselves from evil terror regimes in the region.
Roy Altman, Roy K. Altman, our guest. His name of his book is Israel on Trial. We'll get to it in a moment. Just to expand on what you're saying, right now, do you believe within a week we'll be back at war?
I think anyone who tells you whether we'll be back at war or not is probably a fool. But I think the United States doesn't put thousands of military personnel far from home and all the military build up with the planes and the boats and the ships all over the Middle East in a, I think, very strategic position around Iran for no reason. It costs a tremendous amount of money. And I think when you deploy troops and ships in that way, it's probably because at some point soon you mean to use them.
Yeah. And but if they decide, take the uranium, I got the message. We'll work at it. We will not enrich. I mean, if they want serious talks, but the offer they made, you know, we're going to open up the strait. We're going to charge a toll and we want you to remove the blockade. And we'll talk. We'll start talks about maybe de-escalating when it comes to nuclear. That's a non-starter.
That's absolutely the whole purpose of going to this war in the first place, was to prevent them from ever developing a nuclear weapon. The blockade, the reason they want it to come out, it's the same thing that happened with Hamas in Gaza. Remember, people would complain, oh, Bibi just wants war. He doesn't want to really negotiate with Hamas. It's the opposite. Hamas wanted Israel to leave Gaza, and then we can talk about the hostages. What actually happened is because of Israeli force and perseverance, Hamas was forced to give up all the hostages, even while allowing Israel to remain in almost 60% of Gaza, a tremendous victory for the West over a barbaric jihadist regime. And we should not relent in similar circumstances now with the benefactor of that regime in Tehran.
So in your book, Israel on Trial, Examining the History, the Evidence, and the Law, you feel as though you have to justify Israel and you go through it legally. Why was this your approach?
Well, I've spent the last 3 years traveling around the country to most of our 50 states, to churches, college campuses, law schools, all over this country. And I've had thousands of conversations with people about Israel. And I was shocked to learn the way that people were viewing America in those conversations. Put Jews aside for a second. I always say on college campuses, you think you're counterculture because you hate the Jews and you want to destroy the Jews. Take a ticket and stand in line. That's as old as time. For thousands of years, people have come after the Jews. But Israel is America's closest ally in the world. I constantly in my speeches have naval officers and tech procurement officers from the Army, the U.S. Army, come up to me after my speech and say, Judge, you have no idea. We sell Israel a piece of technology. They battle test it, giving us real-time analysis and assessments for a year or two, and then they give it back to us, having rejiggered the whole thing, and it's 10 times better and more prepared for the wars of the future that are coming than it was when we gave it to them. When our geostrategic allies around the world look around their side of the 50-yard line. I played football, so I like football analogies. They see China. They see North Korea. China's big, but its economy is shrinking every year vis-a-vis the United States. Its army has never been tested. Because of the one-child policy, do we really think Chinese mothers are going to risk the lives of their only son to take an island far, far away? Who knows? They don't know. We don't know. They look at Russia, bogged down in Ukraine against a much smaller and supposedly weaker foe. And of course, Iran in complete disarray, their oil blockaded, their S-400 defense systems rendered totally obsolete by Israeli Air Force pilots and American pilots. Who's on the other side of the 50-yard line? They look at the other side of the 50-yard line, they see us, America. That's a big, bad enemy. The strongest, most powerful army the world has ever known. But what allies do we have? I don't think they're that afraid of the Belgians or the Dutch, or frankly, forgive me, the Germans, or the Australians, who have shown themselves not to be willing to fight on behalf of Western civilization anymore. But there are two allies that have been fighting and winning the wars of the 21st century in real time, and they've been doing it against much bigger and theoretically stronger and more populous foes, and those are Ukraine and Israel. And so is it any doubt? Who benefits? We have to ask ourselves, who benefits from the fact that the vast majority of the negative misinformation we see on our phones and on our TikTok feeds are about exactly those two countries that are fighting and winning the wars of the future, Israel and Ukraine. And so I wrote this book to defend the rule of law, to defend America's closest ally in the region, because we are going to need them in the geostrategic conflict that's coming.
Yeah, I hear you. And also, if you look at, you break down the benefit that we get from our relationship with Israel, the innovation, the intelligence, the on the ground. I mean, for example, we're fighting this war with Iran. The ones who are eliminating the leaders using their intelligence, the Mossad, whatever apparatus they use, have been the Israelis. So that got us the information.
Remember, the Indian President Modi, anybody wants to be friends with Modi, right? It's the most populous country in the world, one of the most powerful rising powers on the planet. He can hang out with whoever he wants. Right before this war started, this is very important. Remember that of all the countries in the world, he chose to fly into a geostrategic hot zone while Israel and the United States were threatening Iran, and fly to a country that's smaller than New Jersey with 7 million Jews in it, smaller than the population of South Florida. He didn't do it for no reason. He did it because he recognizes that Israel is the future. The United States recently signed a memorandum of understanding, a complete transparency, complete sharing of information in AI, quantum computing, and cybersecurity with only one country in the world. And it wasn't England or Germany or France. It was tiny little Israel, thousands of miles away. It's not for no reason. It's because the people who are making these geostrategic calls in the Indian government, just as much as in the Gulf states and in the United States defense establishment, understand that Israel is necessary for the survival and victory that America will need and pursue in the geostrategic conflict that's coming.
Yeah, it's a profitable relationship. And these, I worry that if Democrats ever get power, I think the slow break might happen unless Republicans really stand up. I mean, the approval rating among Democrats is below 30%. With Republicans, it's about something like 76% or 68%. But I do worry about Israel's future with this new generation coming up. Do you, Judge?
We need to be clear that history has shown us that societies that allow Jews to thrive are societies that are flourishing and healthy themselves, okay? Look at the Jewish population in the United States is the strongest, most influential, wealthiest Jewish community that has ever existed. It is no surprise that America is the strongest, most powerful, wealthiest country that has ever existed. Lincoln called us an almost chosen people. He never used words by accident. He chose his words very purposefully because he understood what Washington articulated in his letter to the Jewish community of Newport, Rhode Island, what Adams and Hamilton and Mark Twain constantly wrote about, which is that the virtues and values of America are deeply entwined with the virtues and values of the ancient Jewish tradition in religious tolerance, in freedom of expression, and a society built above all on meritocracy and the rule of law. Those are the values of America, and they're the values of the Jewish tradition.
And I'll tell you,
but on the other hand,
go ahead.
Societies that persecute the Jews, we have seen, are societies that are sick and dying.
I tell you, your book really comes to life. I could tell you you probably dictated it right into your phone. All you have to do is transcribe it. You did it wonderfully. Roy K. Altman, author of a brand new book called Israel on Trial, Examining the History, the Evidence, and the Law. One reason to get it is people are going to challenge you, people listening to us right now. Read the book. Understand your defense. I know you feel it, you know it, but if you want to learn to articulate it, pick up the judge's book. Thanks, Judge. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, man.
Back in a moment.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
You know, the person I felt the most sorry for, honestly, the whole night, probably the featured performer of the evening, mentalist Oz Perlman. He was a mentalist. He was gonna perform. It's probably the biggest opportunity for visibility that the mentalist community has ever had. And then, in the middle of it, pow, 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 the whole thing goes.
Caroline Leavitt, the press secretary, challenged me, said, I'm having a baby next week. And she goes, can you guess what I'm naming my daughter? And I was guessing letter by letter how many letters were in the name.
Is there anything more compelling than a mentalist or magician just describing to you verbally a trick that he would have done? That if you had been there, would have been cool. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
And then right at the moment where you see it happen, I wrote down the name and I said, how did I do? And I turned around and that's when you see the first lady go, oh.
Yeah, that's right. That's when the shooting happened. That gasp wasn't, he nailed it. It was, that was gunfire. And by the way, the shooting happened just as the mentalist was revealing the name of Carolyn Leavitt's unborn child, which, as amazing as that might have been, one would have thought that a more timely revelation would have been to write something on the card like, everybody run.
That's pretty funny. And by the way, Oz came on with me, and that was pretty cool, on Sunday night. And he is fantastic. Anyone who says mentalist wants to put him down, you haven't seen him. The guy's unbelievable, I think. Don't you think?
No, it's very impressive.
Watch anything online. Just right now, go check it out. You could sit there and have a smug look on your face until you see this guy in action. There's no way he's not actually reading your mind. There's no way.
So someone told me a story today when he was on with you guys. He was trying to read you, and he's like, I can't get anything. You're not concentrating.
And it's true.
And it was you weren't, you said.
So I went with Martha to help Brett Baer, and I go, what am I doing here? Brett Baer wants you to help out with Oz the Mentalist. I go, all right. So I'm showing up, and Martha's all zoned in. I go, and he's like, you're not concentrating. I can't get anything from you. So I go, you're right. I'm not. I don't know what I'm doing here.
It's amazing. Can we have him, like, zone in on you, like randomly throughout
the day? It would help. Hey, by the way, if you want to see me in person, I promise to zone in on you. Reno, Nevada, May 30th. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. Bartley Ranch, July 11th, Pensacola, Florida. Tickets are at the Pensacola Sager Theater, but get them anywhere. Red Bank, New Jersey, October 16th. Westbury, New Jersey. Let's sell this place out. Westbury Music Fair on the 17th. Clearwater on the 7th. And then Jacksonville, Florida on the 8th. Chesterfield, Missouri, 21st.